Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, details of the forthcoming Synod of Bishops on new evangelization are announced at a press conference in the Vatican. The UK ambassador to the Holy See explains why his country is working hard to prevent the use of sexual violence as a weapon of war. And one of the leading Catholic voices on environmental concerns looks at the latest record-breaking figures about melting polar ice in the Arctic Sea. Church leaders from across the globe will be gathering in Rome on Sunday for the opening mass of a synod on new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. 262 synod fathers will be joined by several dozen experts, men and women, ordained and lay people, alongside representatives of other Christian churches and religious communities. The synod, which runs from Sunday the 7th to Sunday the 28th of October, will be marked by major celebrations for the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council, as well as by the canonization of seven new saints, men and women from past centuries who have exemplified this work of new evangelization in different countries and cultures. At the Vatican press office on Friday, the Secretary-General of the Synod of Bishops, Croatian Archbishop Nikola Eterovic, presented the aims and hopes of this 13th Ordinary General Assembly of the Synod of Bishops. I spoke to him afterwards to find out more.
I hope that all Synodal Fathers will be open to the Holy Spirit and they will be very attentive during these 3 weeks in union with the Holy Father, Benedict XVI, and in the presence of representative of episcopate of all five continents. That's very important for all the church, new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. A very actual theme, because in our society, especially in the West, we realize that the process of transmission of the faith is difficult in our society, especially in the secularized world. So we will reflect, we will pray, and we will discuss what the Church should do in this situation to announce the joy of Christian faith.
Ecumenism is going to be a big focus of this synod, isn't it? A realization that the Catholic Church simply cannot confront this challenge of evangelization alone.
That's true. The Catholic Church is the biggest one in the world, but we need the ecumenical dialogue to make this announce of the good news on the world with the collaboration of the churches and Christian communities. We think especially at big churches and the Russian Orthodox Church, Romanian Orthodox Church, Serbian Orthodox Church, but even the Reformed community of Protestantism. So all together we should announce with new dynamism, with new energy, with new conviction, the joy of Jesus Christ still present in our world with the good news. Jesus Christ is a good news for the contemporary man.
The Synod is looking ahead to new ways of announcing the faith, but it's very much also looking back to the years of the Vatican Council, isn't it?
Exactly. Thanks God we have a big tradition, we have a still very dynamical community in all the country, even in secularized country, and that's important to start with this baggage from history. That's very important to purify our memory too and to make possible to conversion of each of us Christians to be authentic testimony of Jesus Christ and to announce with our life and necessary even with our word the Jesus and his good news in the contemporary world.
Archbishop Nikola Eterovic, Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops. From next January, Great Britain will take over the presidency of the G8 group. And amongst concerns the British government will be raising with the international community is that of trying to prevent the use of rape as a weapon of war. UK Foreign Secretary William Hague recently presented the government's Preventing Sexual Violence initiative at the UN General Assembly, pledging an extra £1 million to try and fight impunity, support victims and prosecute those responsible for this widespread form of abuse. A team of experts is being put together to coordinate a response to this issue, which is increasingly being seen as essential to the task of conflict resolution and peace building in countries around the globe.
It's the most insidious of crimes, you might say, because it strips away people's dignity.
I sat down with Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Nigel Baker, to find out more about this initiative and about why he wants to work closely with the Holy See to try and stamp out this horrific crime.
Yeah, it's very much a priority of the G8 presidency. It has already, in a sense, begun. It was launched by Secretary of State William Hague in May this year, alongside Angelina Jolie, the United Nations Special Ambassador. And Secretary of State William Hague also presented it at United Nations UN General Assembly just last week. It's really about tackling an issue that over the years, everybody knows it exists, everybody knows that the scale is quite extensive, this use, deliberate use of sexual violence to intimidate, to degrade others in conflict. And yet, we found it very difficult to deal with it. There seems almost a culture of impunity around it. Very few people have been brought to book. The various international courts set up have found it difficult to manage. So we thought it was time both to raise the attention and also to try and do something practical about tackling this problem. So, I mean, it's got three elements. The first is going to be of this initiative. The first is a sustained sort of diplomatic campaign by the United Kingdom through the presidency of the G8 to coordinate the various activities. There are already things going on in the United Nations, different countries, but they're a little bit bitty, a little bit broken up, to coordinate, work with partners and reinforce international mechanisms to tackle this issue. Part of that is also going to be a broader awareness-raising campaign in countries where people maybe haven't thought about this and would like to do more about it, and particularly, of course, the countries where these terrible incidents take place, to remind people that they can't commit these crimes and get away with it, or they won't be able to do them in the future. And then thirdly, a very practical area of activity, which is the creation of a British team of experts who will be, the idea is they will be sort of rapidly deployable in conflict situations to support investigations and prosecutions in these areas, you know, support particularly the UN work in this area, to help build national and international capacity on this issue. So the team would include forensic experts, police, but also social workers, because the third thing will be very important, which is to support victims of this, both to help them give evidence potentially in court against the perpetrators, but also provide the post very traumatic phase of support that is so vital. So as well as that, the Secretary of State has announced £1 million, which will be giving to the United Nations body, the Office of the UN Secretary General Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict, to help their work. So it's coordinating, it's pushing, and it's also trying to do something practical as well.
We've seen terrible accounts of rape being used as a weapon of war. We think of the Balkans, we think of the Rwanda genocide. There are reports that it's going on now as we speak in Syria. And yet, as you say, there remains this culture of impunity. Hardly anybody is ever brought to book for it. Why is that? Why is it so difficult? And how do you think this new initiative may be able to tackle that?
Now, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we've seen it in Europe, of course, in Bosnia-Herzegovina. At the moment, it's something that, I mean, the Holy Father has mentioned very recently the terrible situation in Democratic Republic of Congo, and we are concerned by considerable levels of sexual violence there. And you mentioned, of course, Syria, where we understand that this is being used essentially as a weapon of conflict in Syria. I think one of the chief reasons is the difficulty of securing evidence that can be used in court. These are crimes often committed, you know, by individuals. They may have orders to commit such crimes because it's part of a, often part of a tactic of intimidation of a local population. But putting names to faces is a great problem. Also, a particular issue in some parts of the world is question of deliberate degradation of people, humiliation of people, principally women, of course, that it is almost seen, one might say perversely, but is seen as a stigma on the individual, on the victim of such crimes. And that often the last thing they want to do is have to relive that experience through going through a court case, through even admitting that they were the victim of such a crime. And this is part of this idea of creating a team of experts who can... one of our aims is to help improve the judicial process, including through evidence collection and working with victims. Because the only way we're going to deal with these people, the perpetrators, the only way we're going to get rid of this culture of impunity is allow and help people to speak about these terrible experiences and be prepared to provide evidence that can be used in court. There are UN statutes, there are UN resolutions against the use of rape as a weapon of war.
It's outlawed in the Geneva Conventions.
It's outlawed in the Geneva Conventions, but proving it sufficiently in court to bring people to justice has proved extremely difficult in the past.
It does stigmatise the individual, as you say. It also stigmatises whole communities, and therefore working not just with the women but also with the men in those communities is vital, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most insidious of crimes, you might say, because it not only attacks people's respect, it's self-respect. It's not only about the imposition of violence on another person, but it strips away people's dignity. It really does. It's about, deliberately about, degrading people and humiliating people. And for somebody to respond to that in a way that can allow those in the international community who want to deal with this to take the people to court, and, as you say, have the support of their families while they're doing that, when such crimes instill this sort of stigma on individuals, is extremely difficult. And there are very few cases of successful prosecutions. And we're determined through this consciousness raising, through support for victims, through trying to improve this coordination of different organisations, international organisations who are involved in this, to get rid of this culture of impunity so that people know, perpetrators know, that when they've committed this crime, whether they commit it in Bosnia, in Syria, in Democratic Republic of Congo or any other conflict situation, they're not going to get away with it in the long run.
You talk about bringing this initiative to the attention of the Holy See and working with the Holy See on this problem. What exactly do you mean? What kind of expertise are you looking for here from the Holy See?
Well, first of all, I think it's something that we see as core to what the Holy See messages to the world. You know, the Pope speaks powerfully and constantly about the dignity of the human being. Just a few days ago, Archbishop Mamberti, the Secretary of Relations with States, was reminding world leaders in New York that, this was in the context of global economic crisis, but that at the heart of any policies of any government must be the human being. We must never forget that. Not statistics, not technical fixes, but the human being at the base of it. And we see this as this area of action as something that aligns directly with these calls for respect to the human being, support for the human being, and the dignity of the human being. The Holy See has also, of course, spoken out very strongly about violence, about tackling violence, about preventing violence. And this is as much about prevention as cure, than cure, if you like, because if we can remove this sort of umbrella of impunity that has protected perpetrators for so long, perhaps in the future, potential criminals of this sort will think again before committing such atrocities. Their commanders may think again before ordering them to commit such atrocities. So it's not just about, obviously, helping survivors. It's about trying to prevent this happening in the future. And we think we can work directly with the Holy See in New York, in the United Nations, in the consciousness, in the awareness raising, you know, across Holy See networks. Certainly when we've spoken to people in the Holy See, they've been very encouraging and supportive of the initiative. And so we would like very much to find ways in which we can, in a practical sense, garner the support of the Holy See for this, you know, universal international initiative.
You mentioned at the beginning the involvement of Angelina Jolie, who is the special envoy to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Refugees are a particularly vulnerable, and female refugees particularly, are very vulnerable, aren't they?
Very much so. Often these are women who have been separated from their families. Perhaps their husbands are press ganged into fighting in wars, or you know, they've lost touch with their families. Sometimes they're on their own with their children. They may be in some of these refugee camps, which are, of course, enormous places, and despite the best endeavours of international NGOs and others, can often be fairly lawless places. Places like Somalia, where they find themselves often having to walk for days and days on end, often in violent zones of conflict, in order to reach places of safety. And their vulnerability is immense. You know, one of the sad aspects of conflict in many parts of the world is that these conflicts give power to, generally, the man with the gun, who perhaps have lost a sense of value, lost a sense of right and wrong, sometimes been recruited as a child soldier when he was very young. And these people can be very dangerous, partly because they operate in a moral vacuum. And of course, women and refugees are extremely vulnerable in such situations when confronting such people. So this is where it can't be just about awareness raising. That is crucial to the task, and Angelina Jolie, it's wonderful that she's engaged in this initiative. So we have to raise awareness, but we have to find practical ways to tackle this as well, and we hope that with this UK team of experts, with this work particularly on the judicial side, this work on impunity, we'll be able to deal with it.
My thanks there to Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Nigel Baker. News of the record loss of Arctic sea ice this past summer caused a stir among scientists and environmentalists, who were caught by surprise and warned of some dramatic and unpredictable weather patterns over the coming months. Many experts also see the rapidly shrinking ice cap as a wake-up call for profound and far-reaching climate changes that are already causing untold damage. Last year, a working group commissioned by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences warned clearly of the potentially disastrous effects of retreating mountain glaciers and snow cover worldwide, urging cuts in CO2 emissions and other air pollutants. Among those who warmly welcomed that Vatican document was Columban missionary Father Sean McDonough, an author and leading Catholic voice on environmental concerns. Just recently, however, Father Sean was shocked by the lack of public interest in the latest figures on the record-breaking ice melt in the Arctic Sea.
Well, actually, I thought it was extraordinary, because when you put it in context, you mean that since the end of the last ice age, 11,000 years ago, this has never happened. Normally, the ice is down to about 50%. Before now, in 2007 was the big year, it was down to 30%. This year, now all that's left in the Arctic is 24%, and it's going down. So within maybe two decades, the Arctic Sea is going to be ice-free right through the summer months. Now, we're beginning to understand the impact that has not just on the Arctic, but actually on the global climate as well. And we're seeing, for example, the Arctic, you could look on it as the sort of air conditioner of the planet. Now, as it warms up, everywhere else is going to warm up as well. So there's very little possibility. The United Nations have set, the various conferences on climate change, particularly the Copenhagen one, said we shouldn't go above 2 degrees Celsius mean rise across the globe. With this kind of indicator happening right now, there's probably no possibility that we will be able to keep it under that radar. Now, the Pontifical Academy of the Sciences last April 2011 brought out an extraordinarily well-presented document. They said there, I mean, basically, the faith of glaciers in the Anthropocene, and it was apocalyptic. They're basically saying, we have to get back to 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. We're almost at 400 at the moment and going up significantly. So, yes, you could be talking about impacts on right across the globe. For example, a mean rise of 4 degrees will wipe out the Amazon. The Amazon will turn into a savanna. Much of Africa will be lost to agriculture, and the same is true of Asia. So, in a sense, this should be every political discourse, every economic discourse for the last 2 weeks should be about this reality.
Why is this not happening?
Well, I don't know. I suppose humankind, we have evolved that we're very conscious of something happening right before us. Like, I'm not going to go up on the tower of the Vatican and jump off, because I know if I do it, I'm going to be killed. But of course, I can be smoking away for 20 years. I know smoking actually will eventually kill me, but, you know, it's not going to kill me today or tomorrow or maybe next week. So I think it's something collective like that. And very often now we just want to select out bad news. I'm concerned about my job. My job might be going next week. The mortgage, I bought a house when it was overvalued. I'm working day and night. You know, so, and then, of course, there's no leadership. That's the awful thing. And a very good example of this. This really is catastrophe level. And look at we're six weeks from the end of the presidential election in the United States, and it hasn't featured. You know, the country that is economically and politically the most powerful country in the world that should be taking this very seriously is not even on the radar. So for me, it's a great tragedy, because the reality is what is happening is going to continue to happen. In actual fact, even if we stopped emitting carbon at the moment, it's going to go maybe to 240 or 250 or 450 parts per million, and that's catastrophe. And that's, as I say, from that wonderful document, very clearly written. But again, that wasn't picked up in the Catholic world even. I was probably the only one who wrote about it. So is it, for example, I'm saying it's apocalyptic, is it top of the new event, the Synod on Evangelization? Because it should be. If the world is not going to be hospitable for humankind, and we've 7 billion of them, then this should be number one consideration.
You're saying the document from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences was a very, very good document.
Excellent.
What do you think, who should be taking that up? Should church leaders, do you think bishops in different countries should be picking
this up? Oh,
absolutely,
absolutely. And it's very well written and it's very clear. And it isn't dense science. You know, it's very clear what has happened. And it introduces that whole new idea that actually we're seeing geological changes. You know, it's like the Lower Carboniferous. That was 25 million years. The world changed dramatically during that period. Now, this document is saying is what humans have done for the last 100 years by putting carbon into the atmosphere is equivalent to a geological change. So that really should be concentrating minds. Yes, it should be top of the agenda for every Episcopal conference. It's now beginning to be, of course, in places where the impact of climate change is beginning to be seen, like the Philippines. In last year, you had two major floodings in Manila. Traditionally, that would happen maybe once every 40 or 20 years. Now it's happening every year or every second year. One of the things we used to say that you can't make a connection between some weather event and climate change. But more and more scientists are saying that's not true. So look at what happened this year. In the breadbasket states of the United States, you had a phenomenal drought, the worst in almost 50 years, which is going to have a huge impact on the price of food globally. We had the same in the Ukraine. Again, the yield will be hugely down. We have the same in Western Australia, which is one of the biggest exporters of wheat. So that is going to increase the price of food. It's already gone up about 14%. Now, you just think, the Millennium Goals said we want to halve the number in absolute poverty from around 800 million people to 400 million people. All the indicators at present, particularly with climate, when you take climate change on board, is actually will double to 1,500 or 1,600 million people. So in a sense, we're failing the people as well, because very often in the Catholic Church, we're so engrossed with the population of people, we say, well, we'll leave the environmental issues aside. But in actual fact, the environmental issues are having a direct impact on how people live and on their well-being. And I think, again, I would love to see a synod on creation, focusing, because the Catholic Church has wonderful facilities. You start at local level in a parish, you have the local diocese, you have national levels. So every country would be coming with its own understanding of how the impact of climate change, for example, or and the destruction of species, extinction of species, in its country. So together you would have a tapestry right across the world, and then you could have a lot of energy put behind. Look, this is top issue. We can't put it on the long finger. As far back as 1990, Pope John Paul II, in that document, which was the 1st of January that year, Peace with God, the Creator of Peace with All Creation, he basically said at that time it was something almost of a disaster. So here we are, you know, 22 years later, and we still haven't got our heads around it. We're not articulate in it. We're not even able to talk really seriously about it. And it's not going away because we don't talk about it. It's just going to continue. And unfortunately, to go back to the analogy I gave you, if the catastrophe arises, it's too late to do anything about it. So now is the time we should be actually focusing on it as a moral issue and as a religious issue.
You had very little hope, didn't you, ahead of the 2012 Rio summit, the Rio Plus 20 summit, that there would be any major progress there on these issues. Did you see anything that gave you hope coming out of that encounter?
I'd have to say little enough, you know, because the basis of the original 1990 Earth Summit was there was an understanding that there is common but differentiated responsibilities. For example, climate change is because between the end of the Ice Age, 11,000 years ago, and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there was about 280 parts per million in the atmosphere, which is very small, by the way, when you think of it, 280 parts. Now, the prosperity of Europe and North America and Australia and those guys was built on fossil fuel. We didn't know what the impact was then, but actually we have lived it and enjoyed it. Now that fossil fuel injection has been joined by countries like China, India. They want to develop, they want to have a lifestyle like we have in the West. So they're saying to countries like the United States, your prosperity, you know, you've had it for 200 years. We will be willing to do things, but you have to do much, much more. That's the differentiator's responsibility. And there is very little movement on that. That's what happened in both Durban last year. Well, it happened in Copenhagen. It happened in Cancun. It happened in Durban last year. The United States, we will only move when everyone moves in step with us. But ethically, that's not fair. I mean, because they have had 100, and Europe also have 100 years of freeloading into the atmosphere. We should be taking a much bigger hit as a moral issue. And if you put it down in, say, single moral terms, like if my business and I was pumping noxious substances into your house, you'd come to three moral conclusions very quickly. The first one is what I was doing was wrong. The second one is that to stop it. And the third one, I should compensate you. That's basically what's involved, but at a global level. And here again, I think if the churches were more articulate, they could put moral pressure. Say, yes, your lifestyle has been underpinned by this. Now, it is going to mean your lifestyle will not be as affluent as it was in the past, but it actually could be better in terms of human relationships.
My thanks there to leading Catholic environmentalist, Columban Father Sean McDonough.
And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. But just before we go, a message from the head of the English Programme, Sean Patrick Lovett, about some novel ways of listening to Vatican Radio if you have an Android smartphone.
If you have an Android smartphone, visit our website and download Vatican Radio's first app. It's free. Go to www.radiovaticana.va and click on the icon in the upper right-hand corner.
You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.